I unfortunately cannot resist. It follows up this recent debate about Shockley and Lord Boyle, about which I am sure all of you are well informed, and in particular, well, the press is full of it. I just take now a letter which appeared in the Sunday Telegraph yesterday, and which says, among other things, I quote, "Professor Shockley's thesis was produced from far too small." Perhaps an inquiry. Look, let me perhaps put my point first, that you should then see what why I quote the text. You see, you may remember that when I talked about the fact that science inherited its standards from theology. That means that now if we commit a mistake about theological truths, then we are burned in hell forever. So it is a very serious thing to commit a mistake. So we are better careful. So we should utter only propositions which are absolutely proven. And I mentioned that the church banned Copernicus because it was unproven. And it took off the index in 1820 when they decided that it was already proven. Now you see, the interesting thing is, now what was really so wrong from the point of view of the church with Copernican speculation? Now of course, we by now know that all science is fallible, speculative to a very large extent. Now what was wrong with Copernicus? That its findings conflicted or seemed to conflict with certain truths propagated by the moral authority of the times. Now the moral authority of those times is, you know, about the Catholic Church, and of course to say that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but the Sun is the center of the universe, and the whole planetary description of planetary system as it is done by Copernicus conflicted with the Bible. And of course, if we undermine the Bible, what will happen to society? Just imagine the consequences. So it was a completely sort of pragmatic idea that, look, we have to have social responsibility for our scientific speculations. One can speculate, of course, but unless something is completely hardly proven in a hard way, it is immoral to propagate it if it is socially, if it undermines the basic beliefs of society. Now,
the church and condemnation of Copernicus, when we got in mind that they went on the index, because
it went on the index in 1660.
The initial reaction, as you may know, the British Museum has done an exhibition on Copernicus.
Yes.
And in letters half inch tall, it claimed the stakes. Apart from other areas, that there was no reaction from the church until Galileo, of course.
That was 1660.
Exactly.
Oh, quite. You see, because, I think I said this, that in 1543, when Copernicus was published, there was a preface, actually, by Osiander, saying that this is only a calculating device and has nothing to do with the true system of a true structure of planetary system, and therefore it can't possibly conflict with the Bible. So the Bible is the truth, and this is just an efficient device, actually, in a very, in a very good social purpose, namely to calculate the time of Easter, of resurrection, more precisely than it was done before. So it served a constructive social purpose, and at the same time it was in no way conflicting with the Bible. Now Galileo's crime was exactly, about 70 years later, that he propounded the Copernican system not as a calculating device, but a basic truth about the universe, and he started actually in a letter to some princess, whose name I now forget, in 1615, to start to fiddle with the Bible, reinterpreting the Bible to fit Copernicus instead of like Osiander did, to fiddle with Copernicus to adjust it to the Bible. Now you see, but what I would like to draw your attention to is that the idea of social responsibility of science originates with the Catholic Church. Now it is the Catholic Church which banned Galileo and in fact burned Giordano Bruno in 1600 because they propounded truths which undermine basic beliefs on which the society is founded. Now you see, the so-called liberals of today take their cue completely from the Church, and they say, just as the Church said, that look, you can't speculate irresponsibly. Unless you prove your propositions, you have to think very carefully of its social consequences. And now I read, for instance, this part of this letter about Shockley, a very characteristic feature of the whole debate. Professor Shockley's thesis was produced from far too small a field of inquiry, no larger than a huge opinion poll, and we all know how accurate they can be. In fact, they are accurate for the individual questioned and examined, but not for any other person. The professor may have reported accurately his findings, but they couldn't justify his thesis. Leeds University and Lord Boyle are to be congratulated on their withdrawal of his honor. Now, you see exactly the same arguments reproduced, namely that, funnily enough, truth commands some respect from mankind, has commanded, I don't know frankly why, I have never inquired in this, this is a very ancient thing that truth has to be respected, but not speculation, only proof supported fully. Now, this is the point, originally fully by evidence. Now we know that for logical reasons we can't provide full proof for scientific theories. Now, what are, you remember that actually with probabilism, of course, if that could be fiddled, what is the probability of each given in? Let us say that if it is some truths, of course, have a disaster, I mean, not disaster, certainly major social consequences. Now, say if the probability of the base of evidence is larger than 0.3, then perhaps one could propound this. If it is very dangerous, then perhaps 0.35. Now, the trouble is, as I mentioned, that pH equals zero for any scientific theory. Now, therefore, this morality doesn't help us. Now, you see, the problem whether we should subordinate truths, the search for truths, to social values, well, in this, of course, I don't pass any judgment, I only mention that the Catholic Church and modern liberalism are in the same boat, and in fact, the argument is expanded if you read Cardinal Bellarmino against Copernicus and Galileo, are much more elegant and convincing than the arguments of, say, David Frost against Shockley. Now, incidentally, I can't, well, one more attending and then I go back to my subject. You see, I spent the first, 22 years of my life in fascist Hungary. Now, that was a very curious system, actually. It was a semi-fascist country. And, you see, the regime was very keen that truths which undermine society should be kept under control. But instead of having these, how should I put it, epistemological demands that one should prove absolutely one's dangerous hypotheses, they had a very simple sociological trick. Anything from Marx to Lenin, actually including a periodical of the Communist Party which was published monthly, could be published on one condition, on two conditions. One, that nothing like this can be printed in more than 2,000 copies. So I remember, for instance, when the Hungarian translation of the Capital by Marx was published, one had to rush to the bookshops because we knew that there can't be more than 2,000 copies of it. And Xerox machines haven't been invented then. And the other was that one can't disseminate them among the peasants, only among the workers, who actually were in a rather privileged position. Now, actually, it worked quite well, and so you had a sort of close society of intellectuals among whom everything could have been discussed, and then the rest, this, I think, an interesting solution. But certainly, they didn't put the communists on television and interviewed them by David Frost. Now, of course, I also, so since I talked about fascists, under communist Hungary, if I wanted to read the right-wing bourgeois press of Europe, like, say, The Guardian, I just had to go to the private library of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and I could read it. Now, there were about 200 people who had such tickets. So you see, you can compare the liberty, actually, of societies by these numbers. You see, under Horthy there were 2,000, under the communists it was 200, which to my mind means that the semi-fascist regime was exactly 10 times better than the present. Incidentally, this brings to my mind when I went to study in Moscow in 1949, and I asked for a copy of the Pravda of 1948. It turned out that I can have the Pravda only back till January the 1st, 49, and the rest are on the closed shelves because one is not allowed to look at outdated party lines because that may poison the mind. Now, after this, I want to come back to my earlier discussion. But somehow I think that the course bears some relation on these problems in the sociology and policy of science. Now, well, you remember my example about this imaginary example, just to remind you quickly that how a Newtonian scientist deals with an anomalous motion of a planet. Just to remind you quickly of the moves, we discover an anomalous motion, we conjecture that there's a disturbing planet, we don't find it, we conjecture that there must be some cosmic dust covering it, we don't find it, we conjecture there's some magnetic field distorting the elements, instruments, and so on. Now, I would like actually to give you one more example before I show, which I'm going to show, that all these developments on Popper's methodology are pseudo-scientific, exactly on a par with Marx and Freud. Now, the next example is the example which actually I discuss in Criticism on the Growth of Knowledge. It is the example of the development, which is now regarded as one of the most important developments in 20th century physics, about the structure of the atom, in particular of the hydrogen atom first, and which was developed in 1913 by Bohr. Now let me outline Bohr's argument, and then you will see, and then we shall discuss how these examples, in what sense they are scientific or scientific. Now, the great achievement of Rutherford in the first decade of this century was to discover that while from the Greeks until Rutherford, those people who believed that matter consists of atoms and the void, now mind you, there were two major rival theories of matter throughout 2,000 years, One is that matter consists of atoms and the void moving about and hitting each other and producing all this reality like this hard tables and so on. And then there was the rival theory of continuous theories of matter. I am now only concentrating on this atomic theory of matter. Now they thought that atoms are like billiard balls moving around in the empty space. Now Rutherford had a dramatic discovery, in the details of which I cannot now go, that in an atom, within an atom, there is very little matter. Because an atom is like a small planetary system. It has a very small nucleus. It is called equalizer, the Rutherford model of the atom, or the nuclear model of the atom. The nucleus and an electron orbiting around. Now, so this is a hydrogen atom. Of course, more complicated atoms have slightly smaller nuclei and have more electrons. In fact, at that time, there were 92 different atoms known, and the biggest had 92 electrons and a sort of bigger mass of a nucleus. But let us now stick to the hydrogen atom. You see, now, isn't this quite interesting? Because that means that, for instance, an iron atom is relatively empty. That means, Rutherford showed that one can shoot particles through, say, this instrument, and most small missiles, alpha particles usually, just come out in a straight line because they didn't hit anything. There are very few which are reflected. So he showed that atoms are mostly void space. And they consist of a nucleus with a positive charge and a negative electron orbiting around it. However, there was one major trouble with this model. Although there was an absolutely fantastic amount of evidence bearing out the truth of it, there was one trouble. According to the ruling theory of the time, namely Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, if any electric charge, for instance an electron, accelerates. Now, in physics, by acceleration, we mean change in velocity, whether in magnitude or in direction. Now, if an electron moves in uniform velocity around, well, in a circle, then, even if the magnitude of the velocity is the same, the direction changes. Therefore, we have the classical case of acceleration. And an accelerated electron emits energy in the form of light. But if it emits energy, then it loses its potential and energy, and therefore it is bound at the end to fall into the nucleus. Now, if we have Maxwell's theory, for which this which explains nearly everything that was known about light and matter until 1900, it is tremendous confirming evidence. If we have this Rutherford model, the nuclear atom, for which again we have tremendous evidence. Now, how is it that the atoms are stable, that they don't collapse in their nucleus all the time? That was the central problem of physics, actually, in the late years, from, say, 1905 to 1913. Now, Bohr, Bohr solves the problem now roughly with the following idea. Bohr actually followed up an idea which was previously propounded by Planck and Einstein, namely that energy is itself atomic. That means that, for instance, if the energy of this electron decreases, it can only be decrease by a finite amount. Not continuously, but in sort of corpuscles. Incidentally, the idea of photon, namely that light, has a certain, there are light in a way corpuscles, which was an idea propounded by Einstein 1905, with a definite energy h nu, where nu is the frequency of the light. Now, if this is so, then whenever this electron emits a photon, it would come to an orbit like this, and it emits another photon, it gets on an orbit like this. But, now, what Bohr said was that, first of all, normally, in spite of what Maxwell's theory says, the electron in its circular orbit doesn't emit light. That means doesn't lose energy, doesn't obey Maxwell's laws. Now the interesting thing is, but, he says, if you ionize it, if you put it in an excited energy, then it emits a photon. But there are only, you see, when it, the photons are of specific energy, which determine certain permissible orbits. So that means that we have hydrogen atoms where the electron is here outside, first orbit, then emits a photon, gets to the second orbit, gets to the third orbit, but then we can ionize it, I mean that's a technical term, and then you can get it back to the second orbit, back to the first orbit, but there are only a sort of discrete range of orbits where the electron can move around, and in these orbits are stable, and they don't, the electron doesn't emit any light. Now, the interesting thing is, I plead with the idea to go into technical details, but I shan't. But the main thing is really the main point in this is this. Already before Bohr, you see, Bohr's main problem was to solve the stability problem of the atom. Why is the atom stable? Why doesn't it collapse out of that? But we had certain empirical evidence about the colors in a spectrum. And we knew, well, back to 100 years at least, that we didn't have a hydrogen spectrum. I am only talking about the hydrogen. We sort of discrete lines of different colors. Now, an ingenious and patient Swiss school teacher, Balmer, in 1885 discovered that all the lines, the frequencies of this line in the spectrum can be arranged according to the following formula. Actually, this is really a miracle of patience. But nobody could explain why. Now, I only would like to say that according, if you work out this model theoretically, which actually is very simple, I originally wanted to put it in the blackboard, but you can find it in any elementary textbook of atomic theory. It's about 10 lines and it's very easy to understand. Then you will see the following things. One, that according to this theory, the formula is really this. So, you have a much finer range, and these, where Balmer got his two, you can get any m, and with a fixed m, you can run down n from 1 to infinity. So, in fact, this new formula of Bohr predicts that there must be much more spectral lines, because it is not always two, it can be one, it can be two, it can be three, it can be four, it can be five, and then to each value of n, there belongs a whole infinite spectrum of n, you see? And it turned out, now, it turned out that all these series were found. And this is what are now called Paschen series, Pfund series, Lyman series, according to their discoverers. And apart from, I think, Pfund, who did his discovery already in 1908, where the value is here is 3, all the rest were discovered after Balmer predicted there must be more, and indeed they found it, well, not all, because he predicted infinitely many, but they certainly found it up to the value of m equals 5 by 1925. Now you see, moreover, actually, just to mention this, it predicted that, you see, let us state, now, there are helium atoms. Now, helium is distinguished from a hydrogen by the fact that instead of here having one proton in the middle, it has two protons. And it has two electrons. But we can do the following trick. We can ionize helium, and we can shoot out one of its electrons, deprive it of one of its electrons, so we have a double weight nucleus with one single electron orbiting. Now, the interesting thing is that with Bohr's theory, one can predict exactly what its spectral lines will be like. The constant R will be different, but otherwise it will be a very similar spectrum. Now, the main spectrum of this truncated helium. Now, this is an interesting story. That was discovered by, in fact, it was known among the known hydrogen spectra. You see, Bohr made his discovery in 1913. Now, this Balmer series was of course known by 1885. And Pfund discovered another series with 3 here instead of 2 in 1908. But there was another series known, the Evans series, which it turned out it doesn't follow from Bohr's theory. It is not among these formulas. Now, isn't this a refutation of Bohr? Now, Bohr said, look, that is funny. That hydrogen spectrum comes up in my calculations is a spectrum of ionized helium. So whoever conducted that experiment, he didn't do it with hydrogen gas. There must have been systematically there some ionized helium. And that remainders of ionized helium was responsible for these alleged additional hydrogen lines. Well, it turned out, that was Evans, it turned out that Bohr was absolutely right. It turned out actually why exactly the ionized helium was found to be there in this specific experiment. And the anomaly, or the refutation, turned into a victory of Bohr's program. I now don't want to go into details, but it's interesting that this wrong back in 1881, actually observed first by Michels, who was a great observer, he noticed that some of the spectral lines are doublets or triplets. Now, the Balmer formula just didn't explain anything like this, and in a much later development of the Bohr program, namely, when you introduce, you see, these electrons move with a fantastic velocity near to light. Therefore, Einsteinian mechanics applies to it and not Newtonian. If you apply Einsteinian mechanics and some other things that you are not going to do it, you get the doublets and triplets. And these are just the Zeeman effect, anomalous Zeeman effect, and so on, which were all. Now, let us see. What would that are now, at this stage, we can now go back to Popper. I just now discovered I just discussed two stories in the history of science. One is Newtonian scientist proceeds, the other is Bohr proceeds. Two discoveries and two sort of scientific thought processes, which of course Popper should regard very seriously. But what are Popper's rules? Now, first of all, he says that in order that a theory should be scientific, as you all know, it has to have potential falsifiers. Now, what does this mean? That means that we should be able to specify an experiment which contradicts. But that means, of course, he knows perfectly that the propositions describing an experiment. Now, first of all, what should we accept is an experimental proposition? Let us take the following example. All of you know ampere meters, which measure the strength of electricity, of the current of electricity in a wire. Now we attach an ampere meter to a wire. It looks always like this. And here is a sort of scale from say 0 to 100. And here is a pointer. Now what is the experimental finding? That there is a 70 ampere current in the wire. Is this experimental? Of course, every physicist accepts this is experimental, but of course in fact, Maxwell's theory lies behind it. Of course, we have a theory of the ampere meter. So to interpret this movement of the pointer is that we have a certain amount of current in the wire. For that, we need an observational theory to interpret. Therefore, we need a conventionalist decision. What we consider in a certain context is a basic statement and a potential falsifier, namely, a factual statement, and what we consider is a theoretical statement, first decision. Second decision, we have to see whether it is true or false. For instance, in a laboratory, we have to check before, especially if this measurement refutes a theory. We have to check the device, is there any disturbing influence, and so on and so on. So then at the end, by convention, we agree whether this statement is true or false. Second decision. It is a decision because we can never prove it. There can always be a hidden influence which distorts the measure. So second decision. But if we have a proposition, now then, what does this refute? We always have a huge theoretical framework, and always also a ceteris paribus clause. Namely, the ceteris paribus clause is there in absolutely every theory. Namely, this clause says that, for instance, this and this is the case. For instance, we have the planetary system, we have six planets, we have certain influence of stars, but there is no other factor present. Because if there is, of course, the outcome would be different and the potential falsifier would be a falsifier. So we have to agree on a ceteris paribus clause, and then we have to agree what does the potential falsifier falsify. After all, we always can say, oh, well, if I, for instance, let us imagine that I drop this chalk and it doesn't go downwards but upwards. Now, that, do we say that Newton's gravitational theory is refuted? Or for instance, if an angel appears here and flies upwards, or a bird flies upwards, do we say that Newton's theory is refuted by a bird flying upwards? No, we say, there's a very difficult thing here involved, namely air resistance, and we have to get aerodynamics right, and you will then understand how birds and angels move upwards. Now, of course, this wouldn't explain how, let us imagine that this is a chalk, and somebody knows that I shall just show how Newton's theory exactly measures acceleration downwards with an Atwood machine, and I shall say, look, I should predict that this chalk drops in, say, 1.35 seconds, and I have an exact measurement, and some of my revolutionary students know that I shall do this experiment with a steel ball. And they introduced there, and on the fifth floor, a big magnet. And I drop it, and this thing goes up. Now, will they say that Newton's theory was refuted? No, they said, well, there was a disturbing factor present. So, not only Marxism can escape with invisible American agents, but the Newtonian scientists can escape with invisible agents. So one can always blame a refutation on an invisible factor. So that is part and parcel of science. So refutations, now well, I mean, I indicated enough, are just no bloody good to judge a theory. And frankly, all these system of decisions we need. I now don't go at all in the question of statistical hypothesis, which is another matter, but I I discuss this in the literature, it's the technical problem. But the main thing is that now, actually, Popper's, now what are Popper's rules based on this system of decisions? One, that you have to start in the scientific game, unlike the pseudo-scientific game. It is like a game of chess. Actually, the analogy is Popper's. Science is like a game of chess with certain rules which one has to obey. Now, what are the rules? First, one has to put forward a consistent hypothesis. If the hypothesis is inconsistent, throw it out. And see, Bohr's hypothesis was inconsistent. Look at this hypothesis. First of all, it was inconsistent because it was inconsistent with Maxwell's theory. Because after all, according to Maxwell's theory, an electron has to emit light all the time. And he never contradicted the corroborating evidence of Maxwell's theory. He never denied that, for instance, if I put an electron in a big magnetron and chase it along an orbit of this size, it is actually on the table, it will always, and I leave it on that orbit, switch the magnetic field off, this will slowly fall in the center. If the here there is a positive charge. Now, if it is this small, again it's falls in the center. But if it is only 10 minus a small, microscopic, then it doesn't fall in the center. Now, what sort of inconsistency is this? At what point does Maxwell's law stop and Bohr's law start? We never discussed this. Then, the photon jumps from one orbit to another. Now that's curious. But how much time does it take for it to jump? And where is it? I mean, does it go like this or what? No, actually, in Bohr's theory, in a certain second, the electron disappears here and reappears here. It can't possibly be in the middle anywhere for any moment of time. What a mad theory. It is inconsistent with our most elementary geometry. It's inconsistent with Maxwell's equation. Because, you see, where if Bohr, in his experiments, used an ampere meter, he used Maxwell's theory, which was inconsistent with his theory in micro. Now look at this sheer madness. Actually, Bohr wrote to Rutherford that until he explains Maxwell's success, in his theory, there is no point in publishing the paper. Rutherford said, never mind, send it to the philosophical magazine, I shall arrange for its publication. Thereby violating Popper's first rule of science, namely that one can't put forward an inconsistent hypothesis. Now, second point, Popper says, if there is a, first of all, Popper says, whenever you put a theory forward, you have to specify its potential falsifiers. Under what conditions do you give up, say, Bohr's axioms or Newton's axioms? Now, the interesting thing is that Popper later privatized. You On certain pages, you see, he says that it is intellectually immoral and not, it isn't in the spirit of the game, not to specify for the hard core of a theory its potential falsifiers. In some other pages, he says that, of course, we always refute a very complicated system of hypotheses. But what about the Ceteris Paribus clause? He never discusses the Ceteris Paribus clause. No. So you see, whatever he says, actually, he gets it wrong because, now anyway, because it we have, if we really follow him, we have to specify, when a theory is put forward, we have to specify what we should regard as a refutation of it. And if it, this refutation takes place, then it is our moral duty to drop the theory. Now you see, you may remember here how many times this theory was refuted, and we never dropped it. You may remember that I pointed out here how many inconsistencies there were in the first versions of Bohr's theory. We didn't drop it. Incidentally, from 1687 on, when Newton's Principia was published, there were always a lot of known anomalies to it. To use now the word anomaly instead of refutation. For instance, just our nearest satellite, the moon, didn't move according to Newton's laws. You will discover, if you look at the Principia of Newton, that the Saturn satellite's motion is described in detail, but not the Earth's satellite, the Moon. That is not discussed because, unfortunately, it didn't follow Newton's laws. Now, in 1702 was the first textbook published on Newtonian theory by one of his students, Gregory. And Newton asked Gregory that he should allow him to put an appendix to his textbook, that 1702, 16 years later, which is on the Moon. This appeared by Newton. This appeared as an appendix to Gregory's textbook. But from 1686 to 1702, Newton was completely in the dark of how on earth he can fit in the moon's mad movement in his theory. Now, as we now know, you have now big textbooks on lunar theory, on the theory of lunar motion, and you will find that there are dozens of anomalies on the simple elementary, in simple planetary motion. We have plenty of anomalies, which of course now can be explained by first hypothetical bulges, and then now we, for instance, know, quote unquote, the present theory is that the moon, now this is the moon, that the moon's center of gravity is not here. The funny thing is that somehow the moon must have coalesced. We, of course, you remember that there are different theories about how the moon came about, whether it was conglomeration of dust, of cosmic dust, or whether it was an ordinary satellite which was hot and cooled down. This, of course, connected with whether there was volcanic activity on the moon or not. But we now pretty much know that somehow the center of gravity of the moon is somewhere here, quite all out from its center. Now, this could have happened, for instance, just imagine a fast rotating body all in a fluid state, which, however, cools down, and which, of course, we speak iron masses, aluminum masses, or I don't know what. Here and there, big chunks of masses which haven't reached yet their, say, hydrodynamic equilibrium. So this is not in equilibrium, but it cools down so fast that it becomes rigid before reaching hydrodynamic equilibrium. Now you can imagine that we can have a pretty mad body as far as Newtonian mechanics is concerned, because if the center tilts in orbiting the Earth, of course it produces very difficult dynamic phenomena. Well, of course, nothing was known. So anyway, according to Popper, Newtonians theory should have been given up in 1686. Actually, the book should have never been published. Now, incidentally, of course, in the textbooks of science, we learn that Newton's law of gravitation was refuted by Mercury's perihelion. Now, you know that planets move in ellipses, but as far as the Mercury is concerned, the Mercury moves in a Rosetta light and then somehow it returns somewhere, so it's a sort of closed Rosetta. So an elliptic motion which somehow rotates around the center, you know? Now, this is what Einstein's gravitation theory explained in 1916. But when was it discovered that the Mercury moves like this? In 1816. So you see, you find 100 years of illegitimacy. Now, mind you, I wouldn't make much of it because, as I mentioned, there were hundreds of anomalies to Newtonian theory. And today, after Einstein's theory of gravitation, we have instead of 199, because Einstein explained one of them, namely Mercury's perihelion, and even that very inexact. Now, you see, now Popper has one further rule, just to go through Popper's rules. Once a theory is rejected, you have to put forward a new theory which complies with certain conditions. What condition? That it should explain everything that the falsified theory has explained. Otherwise, if you just weaken it, this is at home. For instance, to give a very simple-minded example, if you put forward that all swans are white, and you produce a black swan, we have to reject all swans are black. Let us call the black swan, all swans are white, has to be rejected. Now let us call the black swan Peter. Now, you are not allowed, according to Popper, to put forward the new theory, all swans are white except for Peter. Because this is an ad hoc maneuver, this sort of exception barring is not allowed. You are not allowed to put forward the theory that all socialist regimes are marvelous except for Russia, China, Chile, Cuba, I don't know all the existing ones. No. You see, now, Popper, of course, is great when he makes fun of Marx